Recording.
This is for the transcriber. The date today is May the 24th, 2008. I'm Dr. Reginald Carter, C-A-R-T-E-R, and I'm going to be interviewing George McCullough, last name M-C, capital C-U-L-L-O-U-G-H. George, would you just give us your full name for the transcriber?
George David McCullough.
Okay. George, could you tell us when and where you were born?
Born in Charleston, South Carolina, 3 May 1934.
Okay. And tell me something about your family and those years growing up in Charleston.
Well, I don't remember much about Charleston. I moved to Brunswick, Georgia, when I was very small.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad drove a laundry truck there, and my mother worked in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
As a cashier and a ticket taker, that kind of thing in the theaters.
Brothers and sisters?
I had one brother. He's mm-hmm. 3 years older than I am, and he joined the Navy just before he graduated from high school, and went back and picked up a GED later and
mm-hmm.
completed high school.
What was high school years like? Do you recall those?
It was Lynn Academy in Brunswick, Georgia,
mm-hmm.
and they were good years. There I was in the band and some social things, and that's where I met my wife. We got married just a few months out of high school.
Oh, sweetheart.
Sweetheart from school.
Yeah, sweetheart.
Got married in 1953, right after graduation.
Uh-huh. So you got married early on. Did you have career goals at that time, or what did you do right out of high school?
Right at the time, I was working on a laundry truck, and I was driving a laundry truck, and then I joined the Air Force. They were drafted people. I thought I'd rather be in the Air Force, so I joined the Air Force, and I originally planned on being a radio repairman, radio operator, and they needed medics, and so, okay, I'll become a medic.
Now, well, how old were you when you joined the Air Force?
Oh, gee, I joined in 1954.
And how many years after high school was that?
That was a year after high school.
Okay.
Year out of high school.
And you were married at the time you joined?
I got married, like I say, I've been married about approximately a year whenever I joined the Air Force.
And so just by the luck of the draw, you were placed in the Medical Corps?
That was what they had available. I had a couple of things, but that was my choice of what they had. It was not much available, I felt.
But no experience in medicine?
No experience at all in medicine.
What was your training like as a corpsman?
Well, I went at San Antonio or mm-hmm. Fort Sam Houston and went through the Army Medic Training Program there.
Mm-hmm.
And once I completed the training program there, I went to Shepherd Air Force Base for training out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trained at Shepherd and at Fort Sam. It was a combination of the two.
Mm-hmm. And where were you first stationed, do you recall?
Let's see, where was that first station? Ought to have you stop that a minute. Let me think on that. Phew.
Was it in the United States?
It was in the United States.
Okay.
And let's see if I can find it real quick here. Yeah, it's terrible not remembering your first duty assignment.
Well, that's okay.
Got stationed. We left San Antonio and that's strange.
That's what happens when you stay in.
That's what, after 34 years in the military, you know, sort of where all you were at.
Okay. Well, we'll edit that.
Yeah, we can add that in. I just don't remember off the top of my head.
So you're ready to, we're ready to go.
Shark it back up.
You were in, and eventually you decided to make the Air Force a career. How did that come about? When did you make that decision that you were going to be a career?
Well, I went to Larson Air Force Base, Washington State was my first duty assignment, and I become a corpsman there, and I worked OB ward for several years in the outpatient clinic there,
mm-hmm.
and that was my first duty assignment, and whenever I was there I didn't get the dates as I was there. It was 1954. I went through training 54 to 61. I was at Larson Air Force mm-hmm. Base. I was medic, and there I was trained as being a pharmacy technician.
Okay.
And I crossed over from being a corpsman to being a pharmacy technician. And I was working in a 50-bed hospital pharmacy at the time.
Mm-hmm. And had you increased in rank fairly fast?
Well, at that time, I was a staff sergeant. I made staff sergeant while I was there.
Okay.
And working in a pharmacy field. From there, I went to Anderson Air Force Base, Guam, and I was a pharmacist there. I had a couple of pharmacy technicians working for me, but I ran the pharmacy.
Okay.
And there in Anderson Air Force Base, Guam.
And at so you were in getting ready to reenlist, and you decided then to reenlist?
Oh yeah, I decided to reenlist.
Okay. And what other things did you do as a corpsman? You were a pharmacist, did you stay in that pharmacist role then?
Well, I was originally a medical technician, and I assisted in, you know, doing inpatient intakes, and I worked OB and delivery. I did a little bit of everything there. I delivered many, many babies, and they trained me how to do newborn circumcision, did newborn circumcisions for a number of years while I was there. And in that sense, we could also repair minor wounds or do minor suturing and this kind of thing in the ER. And that was before I crossed over into the pharmacy field at the time.
And Vietnam War broke out some, or were you still a medic at that time?
No, I was a pharmacist at the time.
And okay.
I went from there to Bergstrom Air Force Base in Texas. And while I was in Texas at Bergstrom Air Force Base, just north of San Antonio here, that's when the Vietnam War broke out. Mm-hmm. And I volunteered to be a courier, and that was in 1969 till 71. I just flew all over the world carrying classified documents from one area to another. I was flying in and out of Vietnam usually at least once a month, sometimes twice a month, as well as going into Europe.
And that was carrying information back to Washington?
Taking information to the field and information back out. Actually, whenever you're a courier in the military or a sealed document, you really never know quite what you're taking. And what you do, we'd go to Washington and pick up a semi-trailer load or anything from that to just a briefcase full of envelopes and bring it back over, and depending where it was going. Sometimes we'd have pallets that must have been 8 by 8 foot, 4 foot, 5 foot high, stacked up with cases of classified material that was going overseas. And during that time, it was during the Vietnam War, of course, and I went into Washington one time to pick up a piece of material, and the courier station chief there said, "This is for your eyes only. You'll carry it, you'll sleep with it, eat with it 24 hours a day till you get it to the embassy in Saigon." And I said, "No." I said, "I don't carry classified unless at least one other person besides me know I've got that with me. I'm the man they got for my station chief." And so he and I knew about it, and I ate and slept with it, and I took it into Vietnam, and it was to Westmoreland, and 24 hours later, North Vietnam was bombed, and I always suspected that's what I took in with the notification of the state they were going to bomb.
Oh, man. And as that part of your career was ending, when did the PA concept come in, and when did that opportunity
I went to Offutt Air Force Base after I got out of Dover, back into the pharmacy field. And it was while I was at Offutt Air Force Base from 71 and 71 is when they started the PA program and started making selection. And the first 100 selected, I was one of the first 100 selected, and they just picked 25 for each of the next first four classes. And I was in the second class to go into the PA program in the Air Force. And it was a joint Air Force University of Nebraska program at the time.
Mm-hmm. Did you actually go on the Nebraska campus, or did you take the courses in the Air Force and they were just transferring?
What they did is the University of Nebraska sent professors down and qualified. We had professors teaching down there, and they actually sent students down from the University of Nebraska at the time.
Okay.
And they were going through the same program we were at Shepherd. Okay. And Jess Edwards at that time, which is still is,
right.
He was with the PA program. And that's where I first met Jess whenever I was in the PA program. Well, right after I got out of the PA program, I was back down for a review.
And Jesse was retired Air Force, so he had good ties, I would say.
Well, he had good ties, and I'm not sure just how that came about.
Yeah.
Jesse would be a battalion.
Mm-hmm. So you learned about it. What was appealing about it was an opportunity, I understand that, but do you understand very much about the role of the PA and what you were going to be expected to do?
Well, they were it was sort of a new role for everybody. It was unexpected, mm-hmm. and of course Duke had put out a couple of PAs, and we understood that the PAs were seeing patients and treating patients, and it would go through a year of didactic and a year of preceptorship. And when we'd complete there, we'd go out into the field and actually be seeing patients with a physician supervisor.
So the faculty, at least for the didactic part, were mostly Nebraska folks coming down with some Air Force doctors?
There was Air Force and some people from Nebraska, but mostly it was Air Force people that had been certified through Nebraska. All the credentials had been certified to be able to teach. And
Who was do you remember the commander and responsible for the program?
I don't remember the name of the commander there at the time.
Now, somewhere close in there, they held the first annual conference, the Academy and the Association, at Shepherd. Were you there or had you left there?
I came back for that in 1973, the first annual conference.
But you graduated in 70?
I graduated in 1972 whenever I graduated from the PA
program.
So
1 year later was when they had the the conference, and you were at that.
Right.
With your PA career, what was the kind of first assignment you were in, and what kind of duties were you doing? What kind of tasks?
Well, it was Homestead Air Force Base, Florida. At that time, the PAs were still enlisted in the Air Force, and they were warrants, and the Army and Navy, once they got their programs, probably the Air Force was enlisted, and we were all Master Sergeants or E8s or E9s. That was the progression at the time.
And how did your duties differ from that of an independent corpsman or a...
Well, really, we worked with a particular physician. There was 14 physicians and 14 PAs. It was one of the first experimental Air Force programs where they set up a PA doc team. And so we had a doctor there. If we needed help, come in, supervise, we were doing the same duties as a physician. Something we couldn't handle, we would defer on to him. Or if we had questions, he would come in.
Was this primary care clinic?
Primary care clinic, yes.
And what was going on at the Air Force Base you were at? Was that a training facility or a...
It was Homestead Air Force Base. It was just a regular
Air Force base. Okay. And when did you get involved with the academy itself? You were just beginning to be the first military... PAs, how did that come about that you actually got involved in doing something with the academy?
Well, whenever I was at Homestead, down in Homestead, I actually started corresponding some with the Surgeon General's office, and I had made a trip up north, and I stopped by the Surgeon General's office, and I was sort of getting information from them that they couldn't legally give out to people, and I was feeding it some of the Air Force PAs. And about a year after that, my commanding officer got a nice letter saying I was being reprimanded because I was giving out information that was not official. And all of a sudden he got a call from the Surgeon General saying that, forget it, and offer him the job of coming to the Surgeon General's office as a consultant, both on nurse practitioners and PAs. So what it was a...
You went from reprimand to being...
Yeah, it was a one-star general that was unaware that E9 had been getting information from the other consultants and feeding stuff to me that they wanted out but couldn't officially give it out. It had to be from some source that nobody could get back to them with. So, but it was unusual because one day he called me up and he said, I was supposed to reprimand you, and I got a call. You're supposed to, if you'd like to have it, they want to send you to Surgeon General for the consultant.
What was that like, going to work with the Surgeon General?
It was really very interesting because being the first PA there, they had semi-regulation written and they had me rewrite the nurse practitioner and the PA regulations for performance. And I was an E9 at the time, a sergeant, and it was really sort of interesting because I wrote the PA regulation and we sent it out and a Norton IG team came through and they were giving an update on everything and we were in a conference. And he started saying things, this is the way we'll interpret that regulation. I raised my hand and I said, I'm sorry, sir, but that regulation was supposed to be written to interpret this way. And he called me down, Sergeant, I'm a colonel and I'm head of the Norton IG team. And I tell you how to interpret this round. The two-star Surgeon General behind me got up and said, sir, he wrote that regulation. He'll tell you how to interpret it and you will take it that way. And all of a sudden this colonel just sort of shrank back into his boots. So, sir, the general George Schaefer was the Surgeon General at the time, and he was very supportive, and if I had problems, I could just go right into him directly. He had no problem with me telling the secretary, you know, can I see him, and if he was going to Pentagon, I'd ride over in his car, and we'd discuss things on the way about getting the subway and come back while he was over there doing his business.
Yeah.
And so whenever we started the commissioning program up, then I was the one going to the Pentagon and working the through week after week after week and feeding information and back and forth on it.
Now, you were in contact with the American Academy of PAs?
Oh, yeah, I was on the board of directors at the time.
Okay, now how did that come about? How did you get involved with the national?
Well, in 1974, at our second one in New Orleans, I ran for the board of directors.
Oh, okay.
And become a board of directors then, and also become spoken for the Air Force PAs, the Armed Forces
you
Services.
Were probably the first enlisted person that served on the board.
Yes, I was. Right. Yeah, okay. I was enlisted at the time.
And in addition to being on the board, other things were happening at that time, like national commissioning and those kinds of things. Did you get involved in much of that?
The national commission was not, but we hadn't even established a national office at that time.
Oh,
we later established the national office. And then later on in Atlanta, we developed the House of Delegates and established that. And I'm not sure how the National Commission came about, because I was involved with the APA and I didn't get involved into that end of it.
Okay. So most of your work is with the association and related to getting the commissioning done,
right,
in the Air Force
done,
in those
yes.
days. Yeah. And when did the concept of commissioning PAs, how did that come about in the Air Force? Was there any outside force for that, or was it coming internally from you guys who were?
Well, it was, as far as I remember, it was mostly coming from inside. We were a bit unhappy because the other service were warrant officers.
Right.
And the Air Force would not reestablish a warrant officer position, and so we were sort of behind. We were E-9s, and in the military at that point in time, I know it happened to me. Whenever I was down at Homestead, we had a naval unit just south of Homestead, and they were doing, there was a Navy, I forgot what rank he was, a naval officer. His wife came in, I did her yearly physical exam and a pelvic on her. And he went into the commanding officer of this naval unit, and he said, you know, an enlisted man just did a pelvic on my wife, and I want to complain. And the commanding officer looked at him and said, well, he did one on my wife last week. What are you complaining about? Because his wife happened to be my Red Cross volunteer, and she asked me to do her physical. So I sort of ended that conversation in a hurry with the Navy folks. But at that time, there was a lot of controversy, you know, enlisted doing pelvic on officers' wives and that type of thing.
You know, Navy had a program, but they were up and running and turning out PAs about the same time, right?
I don't remember when their program started. It started, the Air Force started, and then the Navy, and then the Army after that. Now, I'm not sure the Army or the Navy, which one got started first on their program.
Was there any of the influence of going towards commissioning, did nursing have anything to do with that? Because nurses were beginning to move towards baccalaureate degrees and becoming...
Well, we were pushing because the nurses... The PAs were giving nurses orders of medication on wards and what have you, and there's a little controversy there, and we were pushing for the commissioning, and whenever I got to D.C., we started pushing through, and General Schaefer was backing me on it to help me out, and I got a lot of data both from the AAPA and from the PAs in the field, Air Force PAs in the field, and we managed after about a year out of my life arguing with people in the Pentagon about where we should be as far as commissioning goes, and we finally got it approved.
So the reasoning behind it was that in the hierarchy of things and where you guys fit in as PAs, it made more sense to be commissioned than it did not to be.
Well, it made much more sense to be commissioned because that's where everybody else was, your optometrist was, your preventive health people were, your veterinarians were, your nurses were, your physicians were, physical...
And how supportive were the physicians that you were working with? Were they asked about their opinion about the commissioning of their assistants? Or?
I'm sure they were, and I know that, you know, like any other new program, when they first come in, they didn't know what we were qualified or fit in. But the overall acceptance was great. I mean, it was really good. I mean, after just a short period of time, the Dr. Wheatley felt like we were competent, and they felt confident in it, and they backed us up on things, and it was no problem with it. And they agreed with us that, you know, enlisted was not the proper rank for a physician assistant.
Your past contacts with the Surgeon General and those kind of folks, that had to be helpful.
That was very helpful.
And so personally knowing you and your background probably lends some support, just the fact that they said this is the person we would like to see commissioned as well.
I already had a degree. I already had my baccalaureate. And whenever we were originally, that's one of the problems. They did not want to commission unless we had a degree.
Baccalaureate degree.
And so that was one of the stipulations that we agreed for the commission, that the PA had a year or 2 year period to go ahead and complete their baccalaureate degree if they didn't already have it, and they'd be commissioned at that time.
Now, how did you get the baccalaureate degree? Did you get that from Nebraska as you was going through the PA program?
Through the University of Nebraska College of Medicine. Oh. After going through the program, and I had to complete some other prerequisites.
So you could take some retroactive, as they call them, courses and get your baccalaureate from there.
Yeah, okay. Got a baccalaureate. I already had an associate degree in business administration, but...
So because nurses and other people had baccalaureate degrees, the only way they were going to commission PAs were you had baccalaureate
degrees. We had to have a baccalaureate
degree. Now, it's my understanding you turned down commissioning early on, right?
Yes. I had set up an experimental program while I was at Homestead Air Force Base. The Air Force was trying to decide whether to go with nurse practitioners or PAs for their primary care. Mm-hmm. And what they did, I set up a program at Miami-Dade College and took 30 PAs to RN training, and at the same time, Tucson, Arizona, they were sending 30 RNs through a nurse practitioner program.
Okay.
And what they found, that the PAs completed the nursing program very quickly, and it took them almost as long to train the nurses to be practitioners as it did to train the PAs.
Oh, okay.
And they were already very short on nurses, and they said, why take a short resource? Whenever we can take independent duty corpsmen and people with a lot of medical experience and put them through training and get possibly the same caliber of person, same education and level of...
So these PAs became hybrid PA nurses?
Well, I still carry a nurse credential because of that.
Okay, and because they became nurses, then they could become commissioned.
Commissioned, that's correct.
Now, did many of them opt to become commissioned nurses with an understanding they could still do PA type things?
Well, what it was is they offered to commission us, and I think there was three or four out of the original 30 that accepted the commission as an RN, and they would go in as an RN and be a nurse practitioner and immediately start practicing as a nurse not as a PA.
Yeah, why did you decide not to do that?
Well, I was already working behind the scenes with the Surgeon General's office trying to get the PAs commissioned, and I really wanted to remain a PA. I did not want to go with a nurse practitioner. And that was about the time I went to D.C. and went up and do. It was interesting because the PA program was really new whenever we completed this program. Mm-hmm. Become an RN, and we were at a meeting there in Miami, and it was for a group of nurses and discussing nurse practitioners, PAs, and mid-level practitioners in general. And the nurse got up and introduced me, and she got up and said, this is Georgia McCullough. PA, and he and PA Zwanzinger will be discussing how PA functions, and we'll have nurse practitioners how nurse practitioners function. And right away you can see a little, you know, animosity in the seats, and she took about 4 steps back and turned them all back up and said, oh, I should tell you, they're both also RNs, and all of a sudden you just see a deflation in the audience.
So you don't regret becoming a nurse because that allowed some dialogue?
It allowed a lot of dialogue because in the early days, a lot of times you were told, you don't know what a nurse does, you don't know anything about a nurse. Said, well, I am an RN, and all of a sudden that went away.
Diffused that argument, yeah.
And also whenever I went to the Surgeon General's office and they had me as a consultant of both nurse practitioners and PAs, and writing the regulations, I figured there'd be a lot of problems there. So General Garrett was the chief of the nurse corps at that time in the Air Force. Mm-hmm. I went over to her office right away and said, I'm writing this regulation, but there's nothing going to be put out until it's run by you personally to make sure you don't have any problem with what's being put out pertaining to the nurses. And so she and I got along fine, and a few repercussions early on that came back, she just stepped right in and said, hey, well, you will do it. This is the way it's written. So it was coordination with
it. Give me the timing about the White House assignment and the commissioning. Did the commissioning happen before the White House assignment or right after you got assigned?
Right after I went to the White House.
Okay, but you were working on commissioning before you got
We got it approved. I actually had it approved for the commissioning, and I went to the White House in November, and we had it approved, but they didn't start commissioning until January.
Okay.
And so I was the first one commissioned when it
And you actually had the ceremony in the White House?
In the White House, in the President's office.
Okay, so the commissioning came about, you got assigned to the White House, and the ceremony took place then mm-hmm. in the White House. And all that happened within about less than a year.
Yeah. I went for an interview. The White House decided to add a PA to the staff. Mm-hmm. And they all wanted three from the Army, Navy, and Air Force to come over for interviews. At that time, everybody in the White House medical unit was Navy. And I went over for the interview, and out of nine, I was selected. And I got the word I was on a trip to the Air Force Academy whenever the phone rang out there in the commander's office, and they wanted to talk to Chief McCullough, and it was the White House calling right away. They wanted to know what was going on. And they told me I'd been selected to go into that position. So I was
How did the PA position in the White House come about? Who advocated for that? Do you recall?
I'm really not sure. I think it was Admiral Lukacs who was part of it. I'm not sure where all the pressure came from, but they wanted to try the PA profession. They had not tried it, and they wanted to try it out.
Okay, and the physicians assigned to the White House, were they wanting PAs?
Well, at the time I went down to Carter administration, there was only one doctor, Admiral Lukacs. He was a physician to the president, and I went in as a backup for him, and we had three nurses and two corpsmen.
Okay, and your clinic was actually in the White House? Or
we have two offices in the White House complex. The physician to the president's office is on the ground floor of the White House. It has a small treatment room and set up in a secretary's office. And in the EOB, which is in the White House grounds, they have two other offices over there. At that time, we only had one office, and we did both administrative and the treatment out of that. And then we eventually added just an administrative office and had treatment in one area and administration in another in the same building.
Carter was very supportive of PAs and nurse practitioners and the utilization of those. So did you get a sense of that kind of support for the PAs while you were there? And in a way, you were kind of the role model for the staff.
I was the first PA a lot of them had seen.
Yeah.
So.
And you were responsible not only, you were responsible for the entire staff, anybody that worked in the House.
What people really don't understand, whenever you're in that position or at that time, they may have changed it since then, but our primary responsibility was the president, the vice president, and their families.
Okay.
Everything else was secondary to that. Now, we had our clinic set up there in the White House and the EOB, and if somebody got sick, they could come by and we'd treat them, if we weren't mm-hmm. busy with the president or traveling or going somewhere. And also, whenever we went on trips, both the White House staff that went on the trips and the press corps, we gave them treatment, but all with the understanding it was secondary to where we were on that trip. So I did a lot of treatment that night in hotel rooms where people get sick, and we were busy with the president, five for the president traveling during the day, and we just couldn't break to go treat somebody. Then in the evening we'd treat him once they got back in, he mm-hmm. bedded down for the night.
Mm-hmm. So you were on beck and call because you never weren't given a lot of advance about where the president was going sometimes?
We usually knew pretty much in advance, several weeks in advance, whether we were, where we were going and when we were going, this kind of thing. And also during this period of time, we started doing the medical advances prior to the presidential and vice presidential travel.
Okay.
We'd go out and do a negotiation with foreign ministers' health and set up contingency plans and what hospital we'd use.
Oh,
and
I hadn't thought about that. So you were responsible. What if something happens while he's here?
Yeah, where would he go?
Where he's going to go?
What hospital? And I'd interview the docs and set it up and find out. We'd put phones actually in the hospital, and we had phones in our rooms in each site where we can make quick contact. And ambulance is always in the motorcade.
Now, Rosalynn Carter ends up coming to one of the academy meetings, and I'm sure you had a hand in that.
That was my request. Yeah, I requested it, and she accepted.
Okay, and what year was that? Do you recall that?
I can give it to you.
Well, that's okay. It had to be.
It was a meeting in New Orleans.
Okay. And we'll get the date again and put that in the tape somewhere. Right? So you thought she'd been big nice to have the first lady to speak.
Oh yeah, and she came in. It was interesting because I may have sent you some pictures. If not, I've got some of it. She and I was walking down the aisle, and I was in uniform. That's the first time she'd ever seen me in uniform. And one of her words up at the podium, she said, "I didn't even know George was a captain." You know, and so you know, it was interesting to how that
developed. Being a former military wife, she knew the ranks.
Then. Well, she knew the rank because we had ranks around the right. White House, right. Communication people and staff.
And were you there then when the administration changed and Reagan came?
Yes. I was there during the Carter administration for 3 years, and then but Reagan was elected. I was sent to California as the primary coverage. I was with him 7 days a week from the day he was elected, the day he took office.
Gosh. Oh, even before he came?
Even before president, I was sent to California. Wherever he was, I was for a 3 month period. And I traveled with him, and during the day I was in the house next door to him. They had Secret Service agents and myself. They leased the house right next door, and we just stayed right next door to the house. We could walk across the backyard into his place.
I know you could fill up hours of tapes of experiences mm-hmm. and stories about being in the White House. Is there any particular things that stick out in your mind about your service there, any experiences?
The thing that really, I guess, really always stuck in my mind, whenever you're doing medical advances in foreign countries, you really never know what you're going to run into. And probably the best example I can give you that is New Delhi, India. There are all trauma hospitals there, and infection rate at that time was about 50 or 60% of them elective stuff and trauma. And I went into the head of the hospital's office doing my interview, and we got interrupted in talking Indian, which I didn't understand, of course. And he apologized. He said they had had a monkey problem in the hospital, and this was a repercussion of that. He said whenever he took over, there was monkeys that would come through the window, steal the patient's food, and mess up and down the hallways. And he said, just shoot to the level. Well, there was monkey gods, and everybody got it marmed. So he said, no, don't shoot them, but shoot them with a tranquilizer gun, put them to sleep. We'll take them back to the jungle and do that. But they couldn't get rid of them. And then for the VIP ward, they put bars on the windows like a jail. And so the monkeys was standing up in shape trying to get in. And that was the answer for the VIP floor. The other floors, they were still having monkeys.
And that's where the president would go.
Yeah. But right after he said that about shooting them with a tranquilizer gun, there was one up on about the sixth or seventh story roof, and they shot him with a tranquilizer gun, and he fell off, and he cracked his head on the ground and killed him. And once again, they got up arms over, so that went by the wayside. That was time they put the bars on the windows and that kind of thing. And then he said, after that happened, the monkeys got into the nurse's dressing room and proceeded to string their undies and stuff up and down the hallways. And so he said, what can you do whenever it's a monkey god? He said, people here, they go to the emergency room at benches outside on the sidewalk. They don't come inside till they're called. And it's good luck to feed the monkeys, so they always carry food in their pockets. So when they feed the monkeys, how are you going to get rid of the monkeys?
Right. Yep.
And so, you know, this was one of those things that was interesting. And at that time, what we did is, if anything happened, we'd take them over to the hospital. They would treat them, and they had a small hospital set in the embassy there in New Delhi, and we'd then take him back, and all the medical care would be done in there until we could transport him out. Mm-hmm. So, it's not interesting.
Reflecting back over your career and in the Air Force and at the White House and those kinds of things, what are the things you're most proud of?
Well, just very proud that I was able to be the first on a lot of things, mm-hmm. and being able to be there that close to the president. Very few people ever get to see the insight into it, travel with him, get to know him personally. And when Reagan was elected, I was at the ranch. He came up, I was up on a little hillside, and he come up and he said, "I'm Ronnie, what's your job? I haven't met you yet." You know, just a down-to-earth person. Mm-hmm. And we hadn't, I'm one of those people find it very hard to sit and do nothing. And he and Barney and would go out and clean underbrush and chop weeds and raise still water manager. And I told Ray one day, I said, "I'd be happy to help if you don't think he would mind." And he said, "No, next time come out, ask him." So next time Reagan came out, I said, "Sir, I wouldn't mind helping you if you had an extra pair of gloves." And he went and got me a pair of gloves. Then after every time he came out, he'd have a pair of gloves looking for me around the corner. Uh-huh. And so we'd go out and chop wood, underbrush, and that kind of thing. And
did you have to get on horseback with him?
Yeah, I rode horses. I had to go through a horseback training program out at Quantico and learn how to ride a horse. So I rode a couple of his horses up on the ranch and he was out riding around.
It sounds like the presidents were able to put down their guard when they were around you. You're part of the staff, so you got to really see them as people, I guess, well, not as the personas.
Whenever you're on the ranch, the only way they can get you is a telephoto phone of Lynn's, and he'd wave at them occasionally. We'd go out on horseback or out while we were riding. We were down the tree where they couldn't see us. But that's about the only time they really get it. And Carter was the same way. You know, you go to Plains and they would get upset if they didn't know if he went out in the field. They want to know about it and this kind of thing. And they have very little privacy. So whenever it's just the medical staff and the military aid and the Secret Service around, they really go back to their normal happy selves.
So just being the first at the commission, being the first in the White House, and the opportunity to meet the kind of people and develop the friendships and relationships.
I just feel very, very fortunate. You know, I was the first to be on the board of directors in the military. Armed Forces Survey, I was first committee chairman for that. And then I was selected to be the first consultant to the Surgeon General, then the first PA to go into the White House. And I just feel very fortunate over the years to be able to do this. And while I was in the White House, I was still on the board, but it got to where I was having a problem coordinating the travel and the trips in the White House, and so I did not rerun after 8 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you served on the board for 8 years.
8 years.
Yeah. And thinking about that, what were some of the things that happened with the Academy during that time that you take a lot of pride in?
Well, like I say, we established the National Office on L Street, and then we established the House of Delegates and got that through, and, you know, it was just... We've seen it progress from just a handful of people to what we see here today with just thousands at our national meeting.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable.
It really is. Tell me about your current status. What are you doing now?
I'm currently working to help First Occupational Medicine down in Melbourne, Florida. Mm-hmm. After I got out of the Air Force, I went to Los Alamos National Laboratory, and that's where I got into occupational medicine, and I retired from the University of California and moved back to Florida. And went back into family practice there, but a retired Air Force colonel that I knew was at that time in charge of occupational medicine. He knew I had an occupational medicine background, and he wanted a PA on staff, so he asked me if I'd switch over from family practice and come back into occupational medicine.
Oh, okay.
And that was in the mid-70s, and mid-90s, 95, 96. And so I've been in occupational medicine there ever since.
Since then. Mm-hmm. So how many years were you in the Air Force? How many?
I actually, total military service, I had about a year and a half reserve time. It was 34 years total military service.
And of that officer rank of how many years?
I was enlisted for a little over 20 and officer for 11 or 12.
And what was your final rank?
Major. I was actually up for lieutenant colonel at the time I retired. And what had happened is a two-star general that was running Los Alamos National Laboratory Medical, he was a medical director, talked to me. He said, "You've got a job out if you want to come for an interview." And I told him, "Well, I was up for lieutenant colonel, and I might." He said, "Well, you're facing something that most people won't realize because I've already been told I was almost a shoo-in." He said, "Your age and time in service." And sure enough, I didn't get it. I called a couple of colonels I knew at the Pentagon, and they said, "Off the record." And I said, "Surely." They said, "You're 54 years old. You've been in service for 34 years. You know, it's one of those things that the future promotability and." So that gave me the message, and that's the time I went and put in my retirement paper, moving to New Mexico.
But no regrets?
No regrets whatsoever.
Yeah.
That was a great move. I mean, I have no regrets going to Los Alamos. It was great. They gave me a nice retirement after 5.5 years out there, and so can't complain.
I've been around for a while, and you look at PAs today. What do you see as the greatest challenge for the profession today?
You know, you've got to go ahead, I think, and get all the states to approve narcotic writing probably for PAs. Mm-hmm. I don't regret not having them because to me it's pretty good. If somebody wants them, I can always say my license doesn't cover this. And a lot of times if you know they're faking, it's just easier out for you. You don't have to really face somebody down. But, you know, continued legislation just to make sure that PAs continue to fit in the hierarchy of medicine and continue to progress through the deal.
So being able to practice, still supervise and under some, but having the latitude to take care of...
I've always felt like, and it's my personal feeling, in that we are dependent practitioners, and that doesn't mean you have to have a doctor in the same office
right.
with you.
Right.
You know, I've had them 25, 30 miles away, and that would be sufficient if I need them. I call them on the phone, ask for advice, or even refer the patient to them. You can work independently that way, and I would hope that, such as in New Mexico when I was working out there, only 25% of your charts had to be signed, and you had a week to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of states, you have to have every chart still signed. I would hope that somebody would realize the PAs are proficient enough where you can just monitor the charts at a lesser level than 100%.
Yeah, and in a way, everybody should be audited, all the health practitioners,
sure.
What do you see as the greatest opportunities for PAs in the future, looking at the way healthcare is going and those things? What could this profession do as a profession to grab a hold of some things?
I don't know. We've gone from an almost unknown outcast to being specialty PAs and in family practice. And I think our real roots is still in primary care. I realize a lot of PAs are into specialties now, the dermatology and different specialties. But I really feel like that the need for the PA and the greatest recognition we're going to get is being in areas where you don't have a large medical staff. A lot of PAs have gone out and proven themselves in almost remote areas where they were the medical care. And I think that's given the profession a real leg up on the paper.
So it's that access.
It's the access.
That's the niche that we need to.
And so often you see now that patients will tell you, I prefer to see the PA strictly because he seems to spend a little more time with me, and if he doesn't know it, he's going to go ask the doc, so I feel perfectly comfortable with it. So, and I think that's good.
Being around PAs and seeing the numbers grow and those things, what's your overall impression of where we've come over these past 40 years?
Oh, it's just been leaps and bounds. You know, I've seen where you were sort of a country cousin to being accepted of the profession, and I saw in the paper recently it's one of the most recession-proof professions to be in right now, and I saw it where you couldn't hardly find a job to where you were getting job offers every week, and today I don't know of any PAs, if they want to work, they can't work. I'm semi-retired. I've retired three times, flunked three times, and still at it. I can't think of a profession I enjoyed more. I mean, you've got a very good status, and it's a good profession, and it's good income, and I've just enjoyed it immensely.
Is there anything we've left out? Is there anything you said, gee, I'd like to put in the record that I haven't said?
There are just so many things with the experience in the Surgeon General's office and the experience of the year I spent out of my life actually getting the mission PAs in the Air Force. There's stories I could go on for hours about. You go 1 week and they would ask you, you'd fill them in. The next week coming, they'd ask you the same questions over again.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would question what you had said to somebody else. And I remember one time in the Pentagon while we were working this, I had gone through my spiel and got it 2 or 3 months in advance. And finally, this ranking individual got up and he asked the man from VA, he said, how do you feel about it? He said, well, you should ask George because he knows more about it than I do. You know, and it made me feel really good.
Right.
I've been backed a lot of times through different steps, like I was talking about, by the Surgeon General and then by Admiral Lukacs whenever we were in the field in foreign country where they had no PA. They didn't know what a PA was. He just accepted me as his counterpart, and as far as they were concerned, I was a doctor. I mean, he introduced me that way one time, and I said, no. Later, whenever we got aside, he said, they don't know what a PA is. You're doing the job. That's what I'm going to call you in this country. They don't know what you are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I feel very fortunate to have been with people like that.
So you had people of rank and people who could do things who were very supportive.
Very, very supportive.
For the record, let's name those people. The Surgeon General, the primary person was
George Schaefer. He was the Air Force Surgeon General at
and
the time.
And you spell that S-C-H-A-F-F-E-R?
Correct.
Schaefer. Okay. Mm-hmm. And who were the other folks?
And Admiral William Lukacs was a physician to the President during the Carter administration.
And how did you spell his last name?
L-U-C-A-S-H. C-A-S-H.
Okay. And were there other people that you'd like to get on record that were very supportive of commissioning and those kinds of things? Or?
Well, I've had just so many people that have been very, very supportive of the PAs. I still have a friend that's in Melbourne area. He was very supportive over the years, and it's just so many of them. Dr. Dan Ruge was Reagan's personal physician. He had been in practice with Nancy Reagan's father at one time, and then he took over as Reagan's physician. Actually, he knew nothing about it, and I gave him instruction on what we did, how we did it, and, you know, from meetings and what have you. It's a strange position, and that sometime you may be sitting in state dinners, or at that time I was, and other times you might be in a closet somewhere waiting on you to get out, peeking around the door like a, you know, long lost cousin. So it was interesting, you know, you had to flow with the, go with the flow wherever way it went in foreign countries and in the states.
It was interesting, Reagan was governor of California when they passed the first legislation for PA. So mm-hmm. they eventually becomes president, and he's got you as a PA.
Right. So that's very interesting.
Well, I want to thank you for taking time to do this.
One other thing let me tell you about Reagan, it's sort of funny. Whenever I first got to the ranch and started going out with him, he, Barney, and Ray would ride in a Jeep, and then it got to be Barney and I, he would drive in the Secret Service, they'd sit in the front seat, and we were on one of these dirt roads out of the ranch, and we were going up, and he was going to make a U-turn on this dirt road. And he went up, and there was an old tree stump hidden in the bushes and didn't know about it. And the Jeep went up like this on its side, and Barney, which was a good friend of his, had been helping at the ranch, he was across from me in the back seat, and he leaned over like he would in a sailboat to keep it from going over, and we flipped back down. And right after that, the lead Secret Service said, I think you ought to ride in the follow-up next time, because if he turns it over, I want you to be able to help him and me.
Just put the medical people out behind that.
And another funny story I'll tell you, and then I'll quit.
No, that's okay.
After he became president, one of the first things, we went back to the ranch the first time, I said, look, he's had no privacy since he's been at the White House. I'm going to ride in a follow-up car. I'll just be back here. And so he went out, and Barney and Ray, and he went out and cleaned underbrush and curried horses and that kind of thing. And we were coming back around. They were in the Jeep and stopped ahead of us. And he got out, and Barney and Ray took the Jeep on up. And we were in the Secret Service follow-up car, which is a Dodge Ram Charger. And he waved us down in front of it and walked back, and he stuck his head in them and said, which one of you guys in here are sick? Everybody looked at him, sort of funny, said, well, Doc not out here helping me. One of you guys must be sick in here. And that was just an example of how down to earth he was, and how funny he was. You're a very, very personal person.
Now, who was Barney and Ray that you mentioned? That?
Ray Stillwater was his manager at the ranch.
Okay.
And Barney was originally head of his state patrol security whenever he was governor.
Okay.
And they become very close friends, and the three of them did a lot of construction work on the ranch and a lot of upkeep and that kind of thing. So they were very.
So he just had his common guys that he just liked to chub around with.
Down to earth. And whenever the first one we get back out there, Ray said, man, I'm glad she peeped by. I need some more jokes, because he was a great joke teller.
Yeah.
So, you know, we go out and chopping wood, clean the underbrush, telling jokes. he was a nice guy to be around. He really was very, very pleasant to be with.
Well, that's wonderful. And thank you for all that you've done for the profession and all those PAs that's followed you that's had it a little bit easier because.
Well, I was just in the right place at the right time, is what I said.
Okay. Well, that ends our interview. And again, thanks, George, for that.